Limon Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. Of me, Martinez. With hundreds of fires burning in California, safe to say climate change is here to stay. Unless we do something without freaking out about it, there is a way to save our state without losing our sanity. We'll tell you how. Plus, it's always good when there's new information about our local mountain lions, except when the news is tough to hear. That's all coming up on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm Amy Martinez. Glad to have you with us. Coming up.
We went all in on the big hot dog, and it didn't quite work the way we planned.
Yep. California had hoped to build a bullet train from L.A. to San Francisco, but high-speed rail to anywhere really doesn't seem to be in our future anytime soon. That's coming up in about half an hour. But first, fires continue to rage all across the West, painting the skies orange and red throughout our state. And yesterday, Governor Gavin Newsom gave it a stark assessment.
This is historic. This is the largest fire season we've had in terms of total acreage impacted in some time.
Of those burning closest to us, the El Dorado fire out in San Bernardino is now 23% contained. But the biggest in our area right now, the Bobcat fire, is still at zero containment and has already burned close to 24,000 acres in the Angeles National Forest. That's just north of Azusa. And the air quality is, well, pretty unhealthy right now. But Peter Kalma says it does not have to be this way. He's the author of Being the Change, Live Well, and Spark a Climate Revolution. And not only does he say that climate change got us to this moment, but that there are steps we can take starting today, right now, that will help prevent the next big wildfire years down the line. Peter Kalma is also climate scientist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, but he's with us today speaking on his own behalf. Peter, welcome back. Now, Peter, I want to make clear, you live in the Pasadena-Altadena area, right?
Yes, I am up in Altadena.
Okay, so I ask that because the air up here, you must know this, I'm here right by you too, is not very good. We almost didn't come into the studio today because the smell indoors is almost as bad as it is outdoors. Can you describe how things are right now outdoors, though?
Yeah, it's bad for me right now. I mean, I'm sitting in a room and there's smoke seeping in here too, just as for you. So it's not pleasant to breathe it, I'll tell you that.
Yeah,
I get sort of headaches and kind of lung burning. I think I'm maybe a little bit sensitive to it. And then if you look out, of course, you just see this haze everywhere. It's like every single one of your neighbors having a big smoky barbecue at the same time.
Yeah, that's exactly what it feels like. I just wish there was the food somewhere nearby so that we could have some of it, but we're not getting that. Now, much of California is really grappling with wildfires right now, up and down the state. You, Peter, have been very public on Twitter, venting your frustrations that more people are not connecting the dots between this and climate change. Why?
Well, you know, to be honest, I've been terrified about climate breakdown for 15 years. I started out as an astrophysicist, and I read some climate papers back in 2006. And I'm like, this is really serious stuff. And then in 2012, I switched fields and became a climate scientist. And to me, the scientific evidence could not be stronger. The signals are huge. We're seeing them not just in the fires and the heat waves, which we experienced last weekend. And, you know, the heat waves really ushered in the fires that we're experiencing now. But in the hurricanes, the floods, climate migrants. It's just melting ice sheets, rising sea levels. It's across the board. The signals are just really off the charts right now.
Yeah, it's like all the worst parts of the last chapter of the Bible, right? Revelations. It's like everything seems to be happening all at once for us here.
Well, I want, you know, it's just cause and effect. It's physics. It's burning fossil fuel and releasing that carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And that just that interacts with radiation that otherwise escapes to space, and that causes the planet to get hotter. That global heating is what's driving all of this. And the thing that, when I say I'm terrified, the thing that terrifies me is that we keep emitting that carbon dioxide. We're not stopping. And that's what we have to do as a species in order to put the brakes on us.
And Peter, what you just said is a very easy to understand way to understand all this. Why do you think it's not a connection that most people seem to make?
Yeah, that's a pretty big question. You know, I think more and more people are starting to make that connection. And I'm often asked what gives me hope, and that is the biggest thing that gives me hope. This is a human-caused problem, 100% human-caused. It's not even a little bit natural cycles or the sun getting warmer. Forget about all that. It's not even a tiny bit that. It's 100% humans. And the good news there is that if we chose to, we could stop it pretty quick. I think these stronger, more intense, more catastrophic climate-related disasters that we're seeing. Of course, we're living through the heat wave and wildfire right now. It's starting to percolate into the public consciousness. And that's the thing that's going to turn this around, is when enough people, just normal people in the public, listeners right now, once enough people realize that this is not like other issues. This is the planet we're talking about. The stuff that's happening now could affect humanity and other species on this planet, not just for tens of thousands of years, but for millions of years. It's really that serious. And once people start to realize this, I think they'll say, you know, this is kind of the issue of all issues. We can't affect change in other areas if we don't have a livable planet to do it on. And so this has to be the top priority, and we're going to demand. We're going to get out in the streets. We're going to make noise. We're going to vote. We're going to demand that our policymakers do something about this. And that, and only that, is the thing that will turn this around.
And are those the specific people that your message really needs to reach? Because I got a feeling, Peter, that most people in California, or at least a lot of people in California, are very open to this, if not completely have wrapped their arms around your ideas and what you're talking about. And our listeners, you know, especially, are more conscientious about nature, the environment, and climate change. So who do you think this message of yours really, truly needs to reach?
Well, I think about it in terms of a sort of critical mass. You know, you need a certain number of a certain percentage of the population, I think, to really see this as the top issue. Certainly in our divided political landscape right now, it would help to have support from, both sides of the political spectrum. It's interesting that you asked me that, because I was just talking to my dad on the phone this morning, and he's actually a longtime Republican. And in fact, he's a Trump supporter. And he said, for the first time ever, it's the first time I've ever seen a gap between his
His
support for Trump. Yeah, he said he would consider not voting for Trump because of climate, because he's starting to get so concerned about it.
Peter, that shocks me, because my uncle, my aunts, they're all, you know, Republicans from going back to the Reagan days, even before that, I would think. And I have not heard that yet from that side of the family, that they're willing to make that break on climate change.
Well, I mean, he didn't commit to it, but it was the first time he ever said.
At least the door is open, right? Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I as a scientist, I really wish we could have gotten to this level of awareness 10 or 20 or even 30 years ago. Because the scientific evidence was strong back then too, but you know, it's hard to. There's so many things that are competing for people's attention. And this is so frightening. So it's very tempting to just not think about it. And unfortunately, I think it's really taking these kind of screaming disasters that we're living through now to start waking people up. I mean, I'm glad it's happening now rather than 10 years from now. But I think anyone who's concerned about this, the most important thing you can do is just keep pushing, keep talking, keep waking up everyone around you. It's not just talking about it. It's talking about it in a way that kind of cuts through, that connects to the emotions that you're feeling, you know, to not just stick with the facts, but to accept that, you know, you might be feeling grief and you might be feeling anxiety. You might even be feeling despair, but to not hide from those painful emotions. Because I think that until we fully accept that this is happening, it's going to be very hard to actually do something about it, especially when you consider how much needs to change.
Talking to Peter Kalmus, author of Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. On that, what you're just talking about, messaging and how to reach as many people as possible on this, I'm wondering how much do sometimes does this message have to go beyond the facts and make it more personal, something that everyone can share in? Because I can imagine, look, there's a lot of people out there that can afford to buy an electric car, that can afford to be as green as they can at home and buy all the latest gadgets to do that. But there are plenty more people, Peter, who cannot afford that, who will go get fast food, get a burger because it's affordable and more convenient option, and they don't care about how that burger got to their plate, you know, maybe affecting the environment. So how are there ways to be green that are maybe a little bit more low bar that can still have a great impact?
So a couple of points. So first, I think that you touched upon something really critical to the grassroots climate movement. And part of the reason why it's been getting so much stronger over the last couple of years. Before 2018, the movement, in my opinion, wasn't as strong as it needed to be. It hadn't reached its potential. And it hadn't cut into, it wasn't reaching into multiple kind of diverse areas of the population. Wasn't reaching into communities of color very much. It wasn't reaching into marginalized communities very much. And something changed when the movement started to put climate justice front and center. And what that really means is that this is an issue that affects everyone, no matter what your economic status is, no matter what you look like, no matter what your beliefs are. And I think that needs to absolutely continue. This is not something that any one group should think about. And for the movement to be strong, it has to speak to making a better life for everyone. otherwise, it's too easy to ignore. I mean, it's getting harder to ignore. But the goal here is to recognize that these issues connect to everything, certainly to all of our infrastructure, all of our transportation and food systems, and they are going to change life for across all different groups. We need everyone to feel like they can own this movement and be part of this movement. In terms of kind of changing your own footprint, I actually think that it's a great thing to do for anyone who's in a position to do it. It's certainly not necessary to do that to be part of this movement. And I like to say that we need a billion climate activists. We need to have everyone be a part of this. So, you don't have to drive an electric car. You don't have to have solar panels. You don't have to be vegan to be part of the movement. Those things all move us in the right direction. And, even more importantly than keeping those carbon emissions out of the atmosphere, I think that they start to revoke the social justice, license of the fossil fuel industry and change norms and make it less acceptable to be burning this stuff. We need to shift cultural norms away from fossil fuels and towards alternatives, towards a carbon-free civilization.
Peter, considering that you don't just talk the life, you actually live the life, what are some just practical tips that people could do right now to at least get that ball rolling?
Well, okay, so if you want to empower your kind of your voice for shifting norms by reducing your own emissions, one of the best things you can do is to start flying less. And because of COVID, we've all gotten a taste of what that.
But it took a pandemic, Peter, to get us to fly less.
Well, right, and that's exactly why this isn't a solution. These sort of things we can do to reduce our own footprints, they're not a solution. They won't solve this problem, but they move things in the right direction, and they can make your voice as a change agent more powerful. So when you're talking to people, like if you learn about climate and you give a talk at the library, or you're just talking to your uncles or whatever, if you're walking the talk, then your message that this is urgent and we require systems change urgently resonates more strongly. Shifting your diet is another big thing you can do. Those were the two biggest things. Riding your bike more. I mean, all of these things, we know what they are now and they're pretty obvious. But interestingly, one of the things that the coronavirus lockdown kind of taught us is that we can do all this stuff. You know, we've been forced to fly less. We haven't really changed our diet, but we've been certainly made a lot of changes on the transportation front in 2020.
Well, some people have changed their diet because the same things aren't as available.
Well, that's true. Yeah. Right. And I guess, you know, at some points meat was perhaps less available, but this has globally speaking, the lockdown has taken 2020 and it has, you can see an impact. The projections on the overall global emissions for 2020 are that it's going to be about 10% less than, you know, 2019. Thing is though, that's only, and that's great. But that takes us basically back to emission levels from 10 years ago to about 2010. So we need to, what it shows is that, these kinds of changes register, but we need systems transformations to actually solve this
problem. But Peter, are you worried though? Are you worried, Peter, that, okay, so you mentioned some of the numbers and some of the things that have changed while we've been under this pandemic or going through this pandemic. Are you worried? Because we always talk about going back to normal when this is over, right? When there's a vaccine and we can all go back to normal. Are you worried that that normal is going to be as damaging as it was before?
Absolutely.
That we haven't learned anything.
Yeah. I'm very worried about that. It's when the lockdown started, I was initially optimistic that, you know, okay, so this, you know, we're learning that if we're faced with kind of a life or death emergency, we can all pull together and make a difference on that. And, you know, what happened over the, as the months dragged on, it was the division cropped back up and different factions in this country started going different directions. And to me, that was demoralizing in terms of the climate emergency, because one thing I know is that we are going to have to somehow find a way to overcome this division if we're to move as fast as we need to move.
That bill is due, and we're already starting to pay for it, but we're gonna have to pay a lot more later on. Peter Kalmus, author of Being the Change, Live Well and Spark a Climate Revolution. Peter, thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Anne.
All right, with all the seemingly never-ending fires chewing up California, it may feel as if there's really not much we can do about it. Because if we did know how to stop these mega fires from happening, wouldn't we have already done it? Thing is, we actually do know what to do. We'll hear why we don't when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Fires continue to burn across California today and have scorched through more than 2 million acres just this year. Here in Southern California, the Bobcat Fire in the Angeles National Forest has now burned nearly 24,000 acres and is 0% contained. It's not looking great for us here in the Golden State, but how do we wind up getting here? And what could be done to prevent more wildfires in the future? Here to answer these questions and more is Elizabeth Weil, reporter at ProPublica, covering climate and California. Elizabeth, thanks for coming on the show. Now, you recently wrote a piece called They Know How to Prevent Mega Fires. Why Won't Anybody Listen? Before we get into fire prevention, first, let's start with how we got here in the first place and how did we let it get so bad? So how did that happen?
Well, that's a big question, but there are two main buckets. One of them is climate change. You know, California, as everybody knows, is hotter and drier than it's ever been before. So just before these fires started was basically the hottest California had ever been. It was 130 degrees in Death Valley, the highest temperature ever reliably recorded. So that is making things very dry. And then there is our history of forest management and fire suppression. And that left us in a position with a lot of vegetation all ready to burn when it got very hot, when we started getting lightning strikes.
Now, how did the practice of fire suppression come to be in California?
Well, the indigenous Californians had a really healthy relationship with fire. There was a lot of burning on the landscape that kept things healthy, that kept us not having mega fires like we're seeing now. But the Forest Service was always wrapped up with the timber industry. So there was a lot of incentive not to let the timber burn. And there became a just sort of widespread feeling that fire was bad, end of story. So we got here through culture and through capitalism and a lot of other big forces.
Whenever someone says there was a financial incentive for blank, that never winds up good for anyone that's around that blank. So now to some solutions. What's already known that could help curb these mega fires, and is it being done?
Well, the science around how to manage forests has been known for a long time, for decades. So California is a Mediterranean climate. It's a climate that was designed to burn. Fire on the landscape to be healthy, which has been known for decades. So given how we live in the world now, that fire, we would like to control where it is, right? We would like to keep it away from people. We would like to keep it away from structures. So scientists have been telling us for decades, we need to have managed fire. We need to have prescribed fire. We need to sort of take a preventative medicine approach to taking care of our landscape.
Well, okay, so those are things that I think we already know, and I think that most people, why don't we do it? Why don't we just commit to doing that for a while to see how well it'll work?
You know, there's a lot of pushback. You know, Cal Fire has, their policy is fire suppression. Their job is fire suppression, so that's what they're going to do. There are also good reasons for it. The Clean Air Act passed, and prescribed fire is considered, you know, a human-caused event, and so it is regulated, meaning that it needs to be a day without a lot of smog in the air already to light a prescribed burn and put that particulate matter up in the air.
Now, we also recently talked about the agreement back in August between the Newsom administration and the U.S. Forest Service that plans to reduce wildfire risk through treating 1 million acres of forest and wildland annually, among other plans. How effective is this initiative, and is that enough?
You know, if that happens, it will be fantastic. Basically, we are deep in the hole. We have been suppressing fire for a long time. And people estimate about 20 million acres need to burn to get us back to a healthy spot. But the Newsom initiative will get us much further down the line than we have been, and it would be a lot more good fire on the landscape. So it would be a great step in the right direction.
Now, you also wrote about this frustration of watching the West burn, and I think that's something that a lot of us feel all over the state. For people feeling that sense of frustration, Elizabeth, maybe even hopelessness in the face of climate change, we just talked to Peter Kalmus from Caltech just a few minutes ago about this feeling of hopelessness and powerlessness that some people have about this. What can be done to address this?
To address the feeling of hopelessness?
Yeah.
Well,
fix all our problems, Elizabeth. That's all I'm asking you to do.
I think the thing to do, and it's not easy, is harness that pain and that desire for a better world into trying to make things better, pushing for the policies we need, educating ourselves, educating each other, and most of all, voting for people who will take care of our planet. We need good policy.
Yeah, is there any policy out there that has really worked on that level where people have really decided, look, we want this, our leaders have decided to accept it and do it, and it's had good results? I mean, has there any policy out there has had that happen?
Sure. The southeastern United States has a lot more managed fire than the West does. And it was not easy to get that in place. People fought very hard to make it happen, but it did. And as a result, they're not in the situation that the West is, with tons of dry vegetation that is just ready to burn. And of course, Indigenous Californians, you know, had their policies, their practices that took care of where we all live now.
That's Elizabeth Weil, reporter at ProPublica, covering climate and California. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we're also working on continuing this conversation with members from the Indigenous community in California in the days to come, so stay tuned for that. Now, researchers have been saying it for years. Because there are so few mountain lions left in the Santa Monica Mountains, it's likely that they're becoming inbred. And now, this week, researchers found physical evidence that that's true. They've captured a young adult with a kinked tail and also some other problems. Seth Riley is a UCLA professor and wildlife ecologist with the National Park Service. He studies these cougars, and he joins us now to talk about what this discovery actually means. Now, Professor Riley, let's start with the mountain lion that was recently captured. What do we know about the cat, and what sort of abnormalities does it have?
Yeah, so it was a young male, about 1.5 years old, and he had a kinked tail, as you mentioned. And it's interesting, it's just a bend at the very end of the tail, which is pretty distinctive and something that had been seen quite a bit in Florida panthers in the past when they virtually went extinct because of these inbreeding issues. And then the other thing we saw, which is also pretty important in him, is that he had only one testicle had descended down into the scrotum. It's a phenomenon called cryptorchidism, which is when one or both testes don't descend. And in fact, if both testes don't descend, then in general, at least in Florida, those animals were sterile.
Professor, we're going to take a guess that the tail probably isn't really the big problem here. It's the fact that the cat has that one testicle. I mean, could it reproduce still? Could it still, if it met a female mountain lion, could it produce kittens?
Right. No, it's a good question. Yeah. So the kinked tail, that's probably a cosmetic thing. As far as we know, that's probably not an issue. But yeah, the having only one descended testicle. So actually in Florida, they had less, those males had less viable sperm. They did reproduce some, but it definitely is potentially has an impact. And obviously, if we can't reproduce, then that's a serious problem.
Professor, when it comes to cats that are inbred like this, and you mentioned the example from Florida, the panthers in Florida, if an inbred mountain lion breeds again and again, do the abnormalities and the problems with future generations get even worse?
You know, that's a good question. It's somewhat of a unknown process exactly how it will occur because it's somewhat random. So in any case, when a population gets down to this low levels of genetic diversity, you don't know exactly how it's going to be manifested. That's why actually it was pretty interesting to see these exact same defects that they saw in Florida. But in general, the answer to your question is yes, certainly, like with a very small population and it's not having good connections to other populations and the animals are breeding with their close relatives, then the genetic diversity will get worse. And they were seeing very high levels of these things, like in Florida, 90% plus of them had the kinked tail, and more than 2/3 of them, of the males, had the, you know, the issue with the testes. And so it definitely does get worse.
Now, other than the tail and the other problem, was the cat otherwise generally healthy?
Yeah, as far as we can tell, he seemed to be in good shape, and he's now living over in the west end of the Santa Monicas and seems to, you know, be doing fine. We're not noticing, you know, any difference in behavior or, you know, anything like that. But there were some other issues that they did see in Florida. So, for example, the animals that were highly inbred, low genetic diversity, they died from disease more often. The kittens in that population didn't survive very well. And actually, one thing that they saw there, which we haven't been able to check for yet, but is they had many of them had a hole in the heart between the left and right atrium, And so the oxygenated and unoxygenated blood would mix. And so obviously they were, you know, less efficient circulatory system and just, you know, less healthy that way. So there were definitely a number of issues in that case.
Professor, I know you guys have cameras all over to try and track these mountain lions. And I know this mountain lion was the first one that you got to see with your, you know, right there in front of you. But any other mountain lions in the region have similar problems?
Yeah, so we have gotten evidence, exactly as you said, through remote cameras of two other animals. So we actually, just a few days later, we got a remote camera photo of another young male in that exact same area. So this is in the western Santa Monica's, that also had the kink tail. And then interestingly, we've also gotten some photos of a male in the eastern Santa Monica's, so actually east of 405, between 405 and the Hollywood Freeway, that also looks like it has that kink. And the interesting thing in that case actually is that that animal, you know, and he's not marked, we're not tracking him, so we don't absolutely know that for sure it's the same one. But assuming that is the same one that we've been getting, we and others have been getting photos of for a couple of years, That means that the first case actually goes back a couple of years.
Wow. Do you think inbreeding could become such a problem here that we might have to bring in mountain lions from other parts of the country to maybe help recover or shore up the gene pool?
Yeah, no, that's the critical question. And in Florida, that's exactly what they did. They brought in 8 females from Texas, 5 of which bred, and that actually made a huge difference. The population went from 25 to close to 200, and all of these defects were significantly less common. The big difference here, though, is we have big, viable, genetically healthy populations of mountain lions in California still. And so our goal is, as much as possible, to connect the Santa Monica Mountains to those other large populations naturally so that animals can move back and forth and we don't have to be moving them around like they did in Florida. Although I will say that if we're not able to increase that connectivity, you know, that would be something we would have to consider.
Yeah. One last thing, Professor. I know that we've talked about in the past about these land bridges that could offer these mountain lions a wider range where they wouldn't have to worry about getting hit by a car on the freeway. How does this maybe impact the work you're doing to get these corridors built?
Yeah, so we were already really trying to make that happen, and this just makes it even more urgent to actually see now. We knew that genetic diversity was very low in this population, but we had not started to see actual physical manifestations of it like this. And so it just makes it even more urgent. You know, and we're trying to do the crossing. It'll be a big natural vegetated bridge. And the goal is to have it work for all different species, not just the mountain lions. But you know, especially now, we can see that the mountain lions are pretty much clearly the most at-risk species.
That's UCLA professor and wildlife ecologist Seth Riley. Seth, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, you know, with the pandemic, the last few months, and some of the financial difficulties that everyone has been facing, we here at KPCC have been doing our best to put together shows each and every day to give you the news that you need, that you depend on, and that you rely on. And now with all these fires, our resources are stretched as thin as possible, especially in this building. If you got any room in your budget at all, please go to kpcc.org. That's kpcc.org, and help support your favorite public radio station, KPCC. More Take Two coming up. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and everywhere you find your podcasts. I'm A. Martinez. You might have been hearing the sounds of Kool and the Gang throughout the show today, and that is because co-founder, songwriter, and producer of Kool and the Gang, Ronald Bell, passed away yesterday at the age of 68. So you're going to be hearing Kool and the Gang for the rest of the day here on Take Two. Time now for the latest installment in our new series, Race in LA. Now, in it, we ask Angelenos how race and identity shape their day-to-day lives. The essays written by both community contributors and LA staffers are published each week, and the hope is that these stories fuel meaningful, authentic conversations about our lived experiences as a certain race or ethnicity. This week, contributor Tracy Park shares her essay about a racial incident she experienced here in LA.
Most people of color in America recall their first encounter with a racist. I'm not sure my daughters will, seeing as one of them was still too young in late February of 2020 to consume solids. But I will remember it for them. Playing in our local pocket park.
Ah, no, not on mommy.
No.
The usual chaos of preparing kids to leave.
Bo?
And then the parting shot by a young man hanging out with a couple friends by the park entrance that made me turn my head, wondering if I'd heard him correctly. Had he really just ordered me to get my coronavirus babies out of the park? While my daughters blissfully ignored the exchange, I stood just outside the park gate, seething and doing a sloppy risk analysis in my head about whether or not to confront the man. When you're with your children, fear for their safety nearly always wins over the need for righteous retribution. We left, but I couldn't let it go. I hadn't had any snappy comebacks ready on the spot, so, as only a true reenact and rant at the mirror an hour later person would, I wrote every mean and clever remark I wished I could have said to that man in a letter. I continued adding to it with each new anti-Asian incident I heard about in the news, or from other Asian American friends. Then, my Korean immigrant mother was harassed on her usual Northridge neighborhood walk by a man setting out his trash bins. He told her she had better watch her back and continued to call after her as she power walked on. By that time, I was seeing red. I was furious that my family, my friends, and my fellow Asian American community members were frightened to leave home even just for necessities. I despised feeling like the racists and xenophobes held a power over us, that their hatred and acts of intolerance would factor into our decision-making about going outside at all. And more than anything, I hated feeling afraid. Then I remembered that xenophobia involves a deep and primal fear of difference. Racism is born of the most primitive insecurity a person can feel. It is a fear so profound that the person experiencing it can no longer correctly identify it as fear. And as angry as I was, I could not help but regret the richness and connection all these terrified people will never know by their own choice. The letter I was rage writing began to change as I tried to understand that fear and how it must feel when you realize the world is evolving away from you. Although this letter is addressed to the racists out there, I share it now to bring strength and solace to anyone feeling powerless in the face of this resurgence of fear masked as hate. Trust me. You don't want to trade places with those who hate. Our fear is fleeting. Theirs is forever. Dear racist, congratulations. You've succeeded in upsetting me. You've made me tense during my one weekly outing to the grocery store by following me from the parking lot through three different aisles, giving me the stink eye. You've made me sputter in impotent rage, torn between wanting to confront you and fearful for my children, by telling me to get my coronavirus babies the hell out of our local pocket park. You've made me fearful for my mother by harassing her on her neighborhood walk, armed with only her mask and sun visor, threatening her to watch her back from the end of your driveway. You've made me indignant on behalf of my friends by rudely and dangerously coughing in their faces. You've made me sad by making them feel unsafe, depressed, and undeservedly guilty. You've made me furious yet again on behalf of our Black loved ones who risk illness if they don't wear masks and discrimination and death if they do. You've resurrected old lifelong shame by claiming that none of this would have happened if Asians didn't eat such nasty things in the first place. You mocked our packed lunches in school. You've accused us of eating diseased bats all year. And always, always, you've screamed at us to go back to China, regardless of where we're from and whether or not we've ever been. So, congratulations. You've made me afraid. But now, dear racist, I offer my condolences. I'm sorry that when you flip through the channels, there are less and less of you on TV. That sometimes you're even reduced to one-dimensional characters. The caricature, the token one. I know how you feel. I'm sorry that you wasted so much breath yelling at others to learn English instead of trying to learn more than just English. I regret all the opportunities, connections, career advancements, films, books, songs, and friends you missed out on by limiting yourself that way. I'm sorry for the friends and family you will cut off and lose when they inevitably befriend and become inextricably bound to people who don't look and talk like you. I'm sorry that you will become the embarrassing racist relative whom everyone unfollows or blocks on social media. I'm sorry that your children, as they mature and widen their circles beyond your narrow reach, will grow to be ashamed of you. I'm sorry that when you are faced with the unfamiliar, you can only shut down in terror instead of opening up in curiosity. You see, I won't be afraid to go out into the world for much longer, but you will always be. Xenophobia is, by definition, fear, and phobias cripple those affected. Dear racist, many of us are struggling with social distancing. I'm sorry you've been socially distancing your whole life. To be racist is to choose self-isolation. And in this new world in which we finally realize just how interconnected we all are, I'm sorry that you will still and always be alone. Sincerely, Tracy. P.S. I'm not that sorry.
That's LAS contributor Tracy Park sharing her essay, Dear Racist, How Rage Writing Turned to Rage Drawing, for an artist who's fed up with anti-Asian hate. And yes, that means there are illustrations too. And you can see them and read her essay at LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. All right, the California High-Speed Rail Project is starting to feel more like a dream than ever becoming a reality. I mean, it's been expensive, and the hurdles have not exactly been leapt over with grace of someone like Olympian Edwin Moses. And now things are even looking bleaker for a scaled-down version. We'll tell you all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and also on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. COVID-19 has disrupted a lot of our plans, but there's one project that always has been a little uncertain. That's high-speed rail in California. The original plan was a bullet train between Los Angeles and San Francisco. Now, just a year ago, Governor Gavin Newsom had to scale it back. He said the state could only afford a line in the Central Valley, Merced to Bakersfield. Now, even the downsized plan is in question. According to the Los Angeles Times, delays, land acquisition issues, and the pandemic have thrown the project even further off track. Ralph Vartabedian is a special contributor to the LA Times, and he reports on the high-speed rail project. Ralph, you and I check in on this from time to time. It's quite the story, quite the saga. But for those who may be just catching up to us, can you remind us why this project really has been kind of doomed from the start, it seems?
And when we say from the start goes way back decades. And I think that, you know, it was ambitious. The U.S. has never really attempted to do anything like this. Early cost estimates were clearly unreliable, to put it mildly. So the amount of money we had was never going to get us to where we wanted to be, traveling between L.A. and San Francisco in 2 hours and 40 minutes. It's always been beyond our grasp.
So last year, the plan was a reduced rail line. That one now is up in the air. So what has changed?
A couple things were at issue in the original plan that he laid out. If you think about it, $20.4 billion in your pocket to pay for something that's pretty uncertain and pretty hard to do that's going to cost 20.6, there's not a lot of margin there. What we've seen in the last year is that the costs are creeping up and the funding is under pressure.
So how does COVID-19 play into all of this? How has it affected the funding or the schedule?
One of the biggest sources of funding going forward through, you know, this Bakersfield to Merced line is supposed to start running in 2028. The biggest source of funding in that period will be greenhouse gas cap and trade auction revenues. The last two auctions have been really dismal because the greenhouse gas permits allocations are purchased by people who need credits for the carbon they emit, and very few people are driving. Airline travel's down. A lot of things are down. So there's lower demand for permits. The auctions have come in really weak. So that created a $140 million, roughly, hole in the funding plan. A year ago, President Trump terminated a federal grant for $929 million. That's in dispute, but still counts as part of the $20.4 billion. So they've got about $1 billion or more hole in their funding. At the same time, the costs have been going up because contractors file claims and delay claims and change orders are made. And there's hundreds of millions of dollars of those, and another $500 million claim is pending.
Now, Ralph, I think maybe some people might be wondering, well, of course, COVID-19 upended everyone's life and everyone's plans, but no one could have predicted that. But let's just say for a second, Ralph, that there was no pandemic. Would the plan for the high-speed rail be completely on track with no issues?
No, because President Trump took away close to $1 billion. And the costs are still going up. And some of those costs, additional claims, are going to be paid out of contingency that was created a year ago. It was nearly a $3 billion contingency, but almost half of that's gone. And that was supposed to last until 2028. Half of it's gone in 12 months. So that's not a good sign. On behalf of the authority, they've been struggling with a lot of historic problems. They've been trying to right the organization. But to try to execute something this complicated and this ambitious on a fixed income is difficult.
Yeah, we're talking to Ralph Bartabedian, special contributor to the Los Angeles Times about the high-speed rail project. Now, Ralph, I know there are some landowners in the San Joaquin Valley that had to give up land for this project. How are they feeling right now about this?
Yeah, they're very upset. There's a lot of disenfranchised landowners in the Central Valley who feel like they were abused. The rail authority underestimated the amount and the number of parcels it would need. Today, they need twice as many parcels as they thought they would need just a year ago. So they've gone back to the same landowners for more and more land because they realized they didn't have enough footprint to relocate underground and above ground utilities like wires and pipes and all that stuff. So they're pretty upset. In some cases, farmers have been waiting for years for compensation for direct costs, apart from their land, cost of moving irrigation lines and lost crops because of temporary disruptions to their operations.
And so Ralph, you're telling me that there are some farmers that, number one, haven't gotten paid for all the land that they have given up and all the things that go along with it, and now the state wants more land.
That's happened in a number of cases.
Wow. Now, Ralph, you mentioned President Trump. If in November there is a President Biden, could that affect the project in a different way?
Yeah, that would be a very big benefit to the project because, for one thing, administratively, I think the new president and his cabinet could reverse the grant termination. That would free up that chunk of money. And if they were able to gain control of Congress along with the White House, you could see a new era of rail funding, which Mr. Biden supports.
Ralph, you've been covering this for a long, long time. Is this one of these projects that maybe should never have started to begin with? It just sounds like there have been so many things that have gotten in its way that, you know, maybe we shouldn't have gone down this road to begin with.
Well, if we were going to go down this road, I think we should have done things a lot differently and recognized that a high-speed rail system from L.A. to San Francisco was way over our heads as a first step. I think a lot of really smart people look back on this now and say it would have made more sense for us to build two segments, maybe San Francisco to San Jose and L.A. to San Diego, which wouldn't have required tunneling. It would have served dense urban corridors, and it would have whetted the state's appetite for more, and we could have built towards the two mega cities incrementally. That would have been one approach, but we went all in on the big hot dog, and it didn't quite work the way we planned.
So where does this project go from here? What's the state's immediate next step?
The High-Speed Rail Authority is conducting a formal reassessment of its plan for Bakersfield to Merced, looking at the scope of the project, the schedule, the funding, and the costs. They hope to finish that by the end of the year, and then we'll know what their recovery plan would be. The governor seems to be indicating he wants to issue a massive new contract to execute the Central Valley Plan, which would bind the legislature in the future to come up with money to fund it. That's probably in the next 6 months, some of what you'll see.
That's Ralph Vardabedian, reporter for the LA Times. Ralph, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, eh?
All right, we had some really, really great conversations today about climate change, a lot to get to on the show. If you missed any part of it, just head to wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. We're also all over social media. We're on Twitter at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. That's at AMartinezLA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two is back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.